This is BBC Radio 3. It's 6:30, and we come now to the start of our new Opera on 3 season. This first offering is introduced by James Naughtie.
Welcome to the Royal Opera House and a performance of Puccini's last opera, Turandot, a tale of love and death. The staging here has become one of Covent Garden's favourites, a whirling riot of colour devised by André Serban and first seen here more than 30 years ago in 1984. This revival by Andrew Sinclair brings back to the house a production that audiences always want to return to. It is, of course, a dark story in which violent death is never far away. Lit by the dazzling splendour of an imagined Eastern court and dramatised by one of Puccini's most exciting scores. Tonight's Turandot is the American soprano Christine Gerke. Her suitor, Prince Calaf, is sung by the tenor Alexander Antonenko, and the slave girl Liu by Hibla Gersmava. Our conductor is the Israeli Dan Ettinger. We'll hear from him a little later, as we will from Turandot herself. With me here in our box at the Royal Opera House is Sarah Lenton to help guide us through Puccini's last unfinished opera. And Sarah, first of all, place the opera somewhere in Puccini's composing life for us and the stage that he'd reached in the early 1920s when he set to work on Turandot.
Yes, well, it is notoriously his last opera, and he died before he'd completed it, but he'd started work on it 4 years before. So all he had then was a sore throat, and he wasn't aware that he wasn't going to complete the piece, although he already had troubles with it. He had troubles with the libretto, and he had his own internal troubles. He was baffled by having sort of survived into the 20th century. He's the heir of Verdi. He's probably the last great opera composer in a particular Italian tradition. He knew it, and he was very sensitive to any sort of criticism of being something left over from the 19th century. So he had his troubles as he approached this piece.
And it is a piece that allows some really wonderful production values to flow across the stage at Covent Garden. I mentioned the fact that this production is much loved, more than 30 years old now. Just for people at home, describe how it looks and feels, because it's an astonishing one.
It's a wonderful show. The first thing that strikes you is the colour. Scarlet red, soft blue, purple, lemon yellow, big primary colours to set what is ultimately a simple fairy story, but a ferocious one. So the next thing you're aware of is a brightly coloured dragon prop, indeed truck, which comes on, one of the biggest props they have at the Royal Opera House. On it is an improbable grindstone, and whirring away at the grindstone with an enormous scimitar is a huge muscle-bound green executioner. So you think, hello, not very subtle here. And yet, as these great savage sounds burst out, we suddenly see an old man led by a young girl. And that's the wonderful thing about this show, the savagery, the colour, and the human heart in the middle of it.
And also in the middle of it, an icy princess.
Ooh, wow, no heart there, absolutely. The ice princess, a very ancient figure, somebody that we meet in fairy story after fairy story. And the unease she causes is the old unease of a quite primitive society about a woman who is powerful and beautiful and will not submit to marriage. And over again you get stories about women like this holding on to their power, really, by not allowing a husband in. And Turandot has, as many of these sort of characters do, hedged herself round with prohibitions and, in her case, a riddle challenge. And anyone who can guess her riddles can marry her.
And only the figure of Calaf, this handsome, dashing prince, can unlock her heart.
Indeed. And in fact, Puccini makes it perfectly clear from the moment Calaf strides on stage that he's going to win. There's some blazing confidence about his music and his stage persona, which Turandot picks up at once. As she comes in to dispatch the last suitor, she sees Calaf and is troubled by him.
And so to that plot. The audience, now flowing into the house, can see on the stage with the curtain raised great red streamers coming down and wooden balconies from which the crowd will watch the action. And as the opera opens, a mandarin is telling the crowd outside the Imperial Palace in Peking that a prince of Persia is about to die when the moon rises. He has failed to answer the three riddles that Princess Turandot puts to any man who wants to marry her. Get them right and you are the one. Get any of them wrong and you die. The executioner's axe, as Sarah was telling us, is being sharpened on a giant wheel that is brought on and dominates the stage for a few minutes, with the crowd looking down from these wooden balconies. Now, in that crowd is the slave girl, Liu, and Prince Calaf, who recognises her master as his lost father, the vanquished king of Tartary, Timur. She's remained loyal to him, Liu says, because once Calaf smiled at her. It's time for the execution. The crowd want mercy, but Turandot, who is imperious and unbending, enters in her carriage and is allowing no mercy. Offstage, the prince dies. Calaf, undeterred by the danger that faces him, hits the great gong to announce another suitor, himself. Turandot's three ministers, Ping, Pang and Pong, who cavort across the stage with colourful acrobatics, warn him, don't do it. Timur tries to dissuade him, and Liu is in tears at the thought. But Calaf refuses and tries to comfort Liu. He will face the three riddles and the threat of death. He strikes the gong and calls on Turandot. This is action that is driven by a score from Puccini that surges with energy from the start and glistens throughout with the colour of this fairy tale court. I spoke to our conductor, Dan Ettinger.
You only need to hear the three first notes of Turandot and have the knife stuck in you already. That's gift number one. You open your mouth, you breathe, the first act starts. You don't stop breathing for a second until the very last note of the first act. This, what we call in German, Durchkomponierung. The constant writing and not letting the drama or the music or the tension fall for 1 second, not even to clap after arias. He wanted the tension to go on and to have this large scale of tension. This is the gift, to know from the beginning that you are hooked into the story and not to be able to catch a breath until the very last moment of each act.
The conductor, Dan Ettinger. Sarah Lenton, let's talk for a moment about Liu and Timur, because she is the most touching character on the stage, and her eyes are on her really from the very beginning.
Yes, she is the Puccini heroine. And in fact, Puccini inserted her into the plot. She didn't exist in the original libretto. He needs to have the sort of girl that gets a certain sort of music out of him. Somebody vulnerable, somebody sensitive and loving, who will be crushed by the plot. Which sounds sadistic, but I don't think he means it like that. It's as though he can't conceive that that sort of sacrificial love can be anything else than unhappy. And so he presents us with this girl. And in amongst the drive of the music, as we've just heard the conductor talking about, we actually get that wonderful Italian moment of a voice-driven melody, a slight pause as we prepare ourselves for an aria, and the orchestra gently accompanying the wonderful Italian voice.
And at the beginning of the opera, it is Liu who sings and not Turandot.
Isn't that interesting? That shows that Turandot's the prima donna. There's a very ancient Italian operatic tradition that the prima donna does not sing until 20 minutes into the show. This is to accommodate latecomers and to make sure everyone's settled and she feels everyone's going to appreciate her. Now, of course, this is not why Puccini does it, but he would instinctively know his prima donna shouldn't sing to start with, so he brilliantly, because he's a master of stagecraft, brings her on to do a dumb show. So we're very conscious of who she is. She comes in on an astonishing trolley, takes one look at the unfortunate Prince of Persia, indicates with one chop of her hand what his fate is, and then clocks up Calaf, and equally clearly, just by body movement, thinks, he's trouble, who's that? And then she's off. So we're all set up for this rather troubled princess, but we won't hear her sing till Act Two.
The orchestra has tuned, the crowd, the chorus of the Royal Opera is already on stage, the lanterns are lit around the wooden balconies looking down on the action. Dan Ettinger conducts Act One of Turandot.
Thank you. che ci dona un Dio pietoso. O mio figlio, tu privo che non c'è giro per noi altri del mondo. Ho cercato mio figlio e tuo creduto morto.
Gira, 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 gira soffro, padre, soffro. Nonno, stringiti a me, io pallanito. Qui salvezza non c'è, prendi nella tua mano la sua mano.
Signore, al diavolo ancora.
La vita c'è laggiù.
Questa è la vita, padre.
La vita c'è laggiù.
Soffra, padre, soffra.
Qui salvezza non c'è.
notte senza lumicino.
Scuola nella non cammino, sotto il chiare degli indicchi di Turandot.
Ferro, bronzo, muro, roccia.
La schiena sua carboccia, sotto i muri degli indicchi di Turandot.
Dunque passa lunga a tutti.
Farmi con tutta e quello che sta all'aria dagli indicchi di Turandot.
We'll be right back.
Calaf sounds the gong and calls Turandot's name. He's risking his life in trying to win her. On pain of death, she will put the three riddles to him. He will marry her if he gets them right and die if he doesn't. Christine Gerke is Turandot, Alexander Antonenko, Prince Calaf, Hibla Gasmava, Liu, and Timur is sung by In Sung Sim. Dan Ettinger is conducting the orchestra of the Royal Opera House. Sarah Lenton is with me here in our box just by the stage. That wonderful first act in which so much happens and the emotion runs so strongly in the music, on the stage, from the moment the executioner appears and the poor little Prince of Persia is led away. It never stops.
No, absolutely. And what strikes me so much, especially sitting in this box, is as I watch the different sounds of music that come up from the pit and from the stage, as Calaf banged the gong just then, I could see the orchestra member in the wings taking his cue from the tenor as he banged the tam-tam. And as the little Prince of Persia came on to his haunting tune, I remember reading that Puccini heard a Chinese music box once, and he took three tunes from the music box and put them in Turandot, so that was an authentic Chinese sound.
It's interesting that you spoke earlier about Puccini as the heir to Verdi, and yet this is music which is heavily influenced by the coming of a new century.
Yes, just now we heard the Dead Lovers of Turandot singing. Atonal music, really. Puccini said it was worth going across the continent to hear Petrushka. And you can hear little bits of Petrushka in the score too. So he's very forward-looking, and it's notorious that Fanciulla del West, the opera before this, is heavily influenced by film music. So, yes, he's the heir to Verdi, but he's also a man of 1920s.
Everyone always said that if he'd survived a little longer, he would have been the greatest composer for Hollywood that we knew. the sound, which is all-encompassing, is extraordinary and something new.
I think it's... I mean, obviously it's Puccini. There's something about Puccini. He's all of the piece right from Bohème onwards, I think. But this drenched sound, 80 people in those chorus balconies, and the chorus is in a balcony which is itself a sound box. It's like a drum on stage. And you get this very strong drenched noise from them, from the pit. A tune is doubled, tripled, quadrupled even. So that there's that sound. There's the exotic sounds, which I was mentioning. And, of course, there's the Italian lyricism,
which Liu caught there for us perfectly.
Indeed, and I'm not surprised the audience immediately applauded her.
Although it's an opera that's written in such a way that such interventions are not encouraged. Although, try stopping an Italian audience.
Exactly, and in fact, there is that moment where you catch your breath at the end of an aria, and an experienced audience
that's
can
enough.
Jump in.
And Ping Pang and Pong, who, as I mentioned earlier, cavort across the stage in a riot of colour and movement. They give that exotic flavour to the fairy tale.
And yet, they're very Italian. As you look at their masks, you see they're the sort of masks you can buy in Venice. They are the masks of the masquerade, the commedia dell'arte, and their strange mimic actions, antic actions, are perhaps Chinese, but they're certainly part of the Italian mime, of their folk comedy. And the way they sing, spiky, lyric, as we're going to hear at the beginning of Act Two, but a smaller scale of the exoticism we've been hearing. A very odd sound.
Exotic and menacing. Sarah Lenton, thank you very much for the moment. Let's prepare for Act Two of Turandot. And of course, after Calaf's challenge, he will have to hear the three riddles put by Turandot as the price of her love. This from a princess who appears quite incapable of feeling. I spoke to Christine Gerke about the character that she's bringing to this stage.
I cannot sing any character, I cannot portray any character unless I find the reasons that they behave the way that they do. And it's very easy to go with the predictable ice princess, but when you listen to what she says in her first aria, talking about what has happened to her ancestors and how terrified she is of the same thing happening to her.
You know where she comes from?
Brooklyn.
Or somewhere.
Or someplace close to there, I heard. Yes, I know where she comes from. The thing that is, to me, amazing about the character and difficult is that I have a very few moments to show humanity and show fear and to show that all of this cruelty comes out of her being terrified of something like this happening to her. And, you know, what's interesting to me is in the beginning, the terror is hurled at Calaf. As the riddles go on, the terror is for her. Because with every passing moment, she is losing. And she's never been in this position. Every time I do a production, we always have the conversation. How many men have gotten past the first riddle? Has anyone ever answered the second riddle correctly? And obviously no one has answered the third riddle correctly. And, you know, the amount of men who have made it.
Well, and we see the skulls of the men who haven't.
And, you know, what's remarkable, and she says that, you know, I think quite a lot of men get the first riddle. Because she's like, oh, yes, well, hope's always going to be the downfall.
Yeah.
But guess what? Here's another. And I don't think anyone's ever gotten past the second, and certainly not the third. So
and the old man is watching from his throne.
Yes, happily, probably waiting to get rid of his daughter.
What is she like inside, do you think?
I think that she has to be strong, but I don't know that she is. She has a facade, and it's interesting because women in this piece pick up on it faster than anyone else. Liu sees through her right away. And I think that the only way to create some kind of humanity for Turandot is to relate to Liu, to understand how strong Liu is and what Liu is giving up, and that it's not scary for her to give this up. And perhaps it's not so scary to give into it. It's remarkable to see Liu's strength, not just throughout the entire piece, but especially in her final moments. My favorite thing is when she has the nerve to call royalty too. Oh, my goodness. That is gigantic.
For those who know the production, they can imagine it. Many won't have seen it. And it's a wonderful mixture of colour and darkness. Mm-hmm. You feel the ice, but you also feel the extraordinary depth of the emotion.
Absolutely. And what's remarkable to me is, aside from just having these vivid colors on the main characters, they're made more vivid and more alive. They have become more alive because of the darkness of the background, because of the fact that it's nighttime. And it's just remarkable to see all of these wildly bright colors being hurled at you as much as the music is encapsulating you.
Christine Gerke on the way that André Servan's production for the Royal Opera envelops the stage as much as Puccini's relentless and all-surrounding score. Now, at the beginning of Act Two, which we're about to hear, Ping Pang and Pong, Turandot's ministers, are lamenting the bloody state of her reign and praying for her to discover love. Small chance. They think of their homes in the country, far away from the court, and then the crowd is back. They're going to hear the riddles again, and Calaf's answers. The old emperor, who descends on his throne to the stage from high above, he's sung by Robin Leggett, tries to put Calaf off once more, but no. Turandot comes in and describes how the killing of one of her ancestors by a prince turned her against men forever. She sings the great aria in Questa Regia. Then the questions, the riddles. What is born each night and dies at dawn? He answers, hope. What flickers red and hot like a flame, but isn't a flame? Blood. He's right. Can he answer the third question? What is like ice, but burns? There's silence for a moment. Then comes the answer. Turandot. She speaks to the emperor. Does she have to take him? He's answered the riddles. But Calaf then has a challenge of his own. If she can find out his name by dawn, he will go to his death. And as the act ends, we hear the notes of his famous aria Nessun Dorma that is going to open Act Three. Sarah Lenton, this is the moment when Turandot and Calaf come together and
yes.
sing together.
This is so well constructed. We've had the ministers sing their little Chinese bit. We've had quiet sounds. At the moment, a harpist is putting paper through her strings to create a funny Chinese noise for the opening of Act Two. We've had her father, that quavering old voice, singing amongst fanfares. And then we get the great Puccini dramatic soprano, icy splendour, top C's, big voice, answering and challenging an equally heroic Calaf. So two almost monsters on stage, blazing with confidence. And not only is the strength of these enormous voices carrying the drama forward, we're already grappling with the problem that Puccini grappled with, which is how to make these very large personalities human. And that answer will come in Act 3, but really at the end of Act 2, we're beginning to see it. Turandot's collapse when he answers the riddles, and actually Calaf's generosity as he offers her a chance with his riddle.
Sarah, thank you. In this production of Turandot, Christine Gerke is the Ice Princess, Alexander Antonienko is singing Calaf, Hibla Gasmava is singing Liu, Insang Sim is Timur, her master, and the Emperor, descending to the stage on his throne, is Robin Leggett. The audience is settling down. The lights are dimmed. Dan Ettinger is ready to conduct Act 2 of Puccini's Turandot.
Desta la reggia e desta la città. Siamo pronti ad ogni evento. Se lo straniero vince per le nozze e se gli perde per il seppellimento.
Io preparo le nozze
ed io le sequie.
Le rosse lanterne di festa
e bianche lanterne di lutto.
L'incensi e l'offerte,
l'incensi e le offerte,
monete di
zucchero, dolci moscate, il fere sgrondante del fatto.
I ponzi che cantano,
i ponzi che gemono, e tutto quanto il resto secondo vuole il rito minuzioso, infinito.
Oh,
stillarmi il cervel sui libri sacri.
Thank you. dove ne va.
Figlio del cielo, io chiedo ad affrontar la prova.
A che io possa morir senza portare il peso della tua giovine vita.
Figlio del cielo, io chiedo ad affrontar la prova.
Thank you. Thank you.
The end of Act Two of Turandot with Prince Calaf's challenge to Turandot. Can she find out his name by dawn? If she does, he will die. Alexander Antonenko is Calaf. Christine Gerke Turandot in this performance from the Royal Opera House, conducted by Dan Ettinger. You also heard there the choristers who are supplementing the Covent Garden Chorus. They're from the Schola Cantorum of the Cardinal Vaughan Memorial School here in London. Sarah Lenton is beside me here in our box, looking down on this wonderfully colourful production, as we've said several times. It really is one of the ones that has established itself in the repertoire as a house favourite, and one can see why.
Oh, it's completely itself, and it is completely theatrical in the way that Puccini would have loved. He used to say, rather alarmingly, that a mistimed curtain could ruin a whole show, which it must really ring in the ears of our poor stage manager. And I was just watching and I was thinking, yes, how technically adroit. At the end, there was a complete blackout, even the pit went black. And yet, how old-fashioned, how wonderful that the Son of Heaven rides up into the flies on his chariot, just as they did in Monteverdi's time.
You've written a fascinating piece in the Covent Garden programme about what goes on behind the scenes in this production, and it's quite a task.
The Emperor is a case in point, because he's got to be up in the wings before he comes down, and he's got to be taken up there while the curtain is down. So the poor man's up there for about 40 minutes. Above the lamps, which are, of course, very hot, covered in his wonderful brocade. And I know there's a pencil note in the stage manager's score, just which you'll be looking at right now, which is clear the stage, get Act Three ready, get the Emperor down. And then, of course, he'll have to go up again.
Otherwise, he'll be there for 10,000 years, as they've been singing.
Yes, indeed.
The choreography is a very important part of this particular production.
It is, and that's partly the genesis of this production. It was put on terribly quickly for the Los Angeles Cultural Olympics back in 1984. Very little time to rehearse, 80 people in the chorus and the kids, as you've just mentioned, and there was just no time to rehearse that many people. So what they did is they put the chorus in their sort of balconies, and they still act and react, of course, but on stage the action is dominated by a troupe of dancers. And wonderfully, the choreographer keeps their dancing fresh from production to production to production. I think it's one of the reasons this show works so well. They're doing Tai Chi and Kung Fu gestures, but she always gives it a little shake before every production and makes it slightly new.
In a way, it's a nod to the wizardry that Puccini had as a dramatist, as a man putting in musical theatre on the stage.
Actually, Puccini's thought to be producer-proof. You almost don't have to cue the singers on stage. Their entrances are absolutely fixed in the score. You can't muck around with them. Or you'll get into big trouble if you do.
Benjamin Britten said that one of the reasons he was a genius as an opera composer was he knew how long it took for someone to walk from one side of the stage
did
to the other.
Really? I didn't
he
know
did,
that.
Yes.
How wonderful.
It catches it rather well, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes.
Well, by the time Puccini had started Turandot, he'd already gone through many stages of development, as we know, as an operatic composer. I spoke to today's conductor, Dan Ettinger, about where Turandot found him.
I think he was mostly exploring. He already explored with Butterfly, but that was a very subtle, gentle explore of Japan. But going further to China, to this even more massive population, which I'm sure made the piece to be so massive in proportion, he explored so many new things, new harmonies, new pentatonic melodies, new instrumentation, using so many different percussion instruments in the pit, and not only Japanese or Chinese gongs, but all the impossible percussions in all different combinations. This is what he explored.
You mentioned the pentatonic flavour of this opera. Was he deliberately, do you think, trying to find new ways of expressing himself that he hadn't tried or perhaps didn't know instinctively 20, 30 years before?
I think he was just the master of verismo. And verismo is reality. And when you travel east, you travel east. Then you speak the language of the east and the music language of the east. Of course, it's not really the music language, but it's really influenced by the Oriental, or what he thought Oriental musical language was or is. And what makes it so genius is that it is almost authentic, but it's still so much Puccini.
And the great skill that he had, the genius, was to move the story so quickly, so fast. People always say that he could have written for the movies, you know, if he'd lived another 20 years. He had that extraordinary gift of compression and speed.
Yeah, I mean, people always say that Tosca is maybe the best thriller movie music. It's true. And I think going back to what Verismo is writing the perfect music in the perfect timing for the perfect realismus in the story. It's not those, you know, Mozart operas or Wagner operas which you can go hours and hours with one line and develop it. He is developing a story, and his tempo accompanying this drama is what makes his Verismo so special.
What about the ending? Unfinished opera.
Well, unfinished opera. I've done productions where we finished with Liu's death. Works as well. Unfair for especially the main character, Turandot, because she doesn't have a chance to develop. From all the endings that we know, and the Berio became a bit popular 10 years ago, but we all went back to the original Alfano, but actually not to the original, to the short version that Toscanini cut.
And you still think that's the best?
I actually think that the original Alfano, before Toscanini cut it, is much better. It's longer. The musical language develops even more, which makes us think where Puccini might have developed it, or where, or who was Alfano. It's longer. It gives also dramaturgically a chance to the two main characters, but especially for Turandot, to develop it a little bit more than what she gets, even with the complete short Alfano version. My favorite is the long Alfano version, but the one we are doing is the normal one, the usual one. It works. It's grandiose. It's gigantic. And it's a wow ending to the piece.
Dan Ettinger, our conductor, who incidentally is music director of the Stuttgart Philharmonic Orchestra and also music director of Mannheim Opera House. Sarah Lenton with me here, listening to the conductor talking about his favourite ending. Let's just talk about that, because it was a problem that had to be solved at the beginning.
Puccini set himself a problem for himself. How was love going to conquer all? This is not a normal Puccini ending by any manner of means. It is not hardly surprising that after Liu's death, Puccini found himself stuck. And some people say, oh, well, he couldn't end it, you know. And yet, he wanted to end it. I think it's right for us to go on to the ending he wanted. If he couldn't do it, somebody else had to. It's almost a collaboration. Not that, he realised that. The notes were there for the way it was ended, and Alfano was brought in by his publishers to make something of those notes, to enflesh them, and we've got the Alfano ending. And I think it's right. I think it's perhaps as though Puccini couldn't end it. He needed a brasher, lesser composer to end it in a way, and that's what we get.
Why did Toscanini cut it?
Because Alfano put in far too much of Alfano in Toscanini's view, and famously on the first night, Toscanini put his baton down at the end of Liu's scene and said, the master died here, we're going to stop. So he wasn't going to let some other composer dominate the last scene. But I think the Puccini generosity is very present in that last scene. It's not just that the ice princess melts. It's also an exchange of generosity between the two characters. Calaf gives her his name and offers his life as a result. She says, I've got you. That down comes the emperor again, in come the chorus, I've got his name. And then when she says it's love.
Well, let's talk about Act Three, in which we reach the climax of the opera. Calaf, at the beginning of the act, sings Nessun Dorma, no one must sleep. His name has to remain secret until dawn, or he dies by his own promise. Ping, Pang and Pong think he's doomed. They tell him to get out. A mob threatens him. They drag in Liu and her master, Timur. Calaf says they don't know the secret, but when Turandot arrives, Liu says that she alone does know, but she won't tell. She's tortured. She still holds her tongue. Even Turandot is impressed and asks Liu's secret. It's love, she says. And she believes that Turandot herself will one day know love, despite all the evidence we've seen to the contrary. Then Liu takes a knife and kills herself. The crowd carry her away, and Calaf impetuously kisses Turandot. The ice starts to melt. Calaf believes he's won her. He reveals who he is. Turandot turns to the emperor and says that she too knows his name. It is
love. And the music, as we move towards the end of the opera, Sarah, is truly thrilling.
Yeah, it's a great sound, and it's a fitting end to a great Italian opera tradition, I think.
Turandot asks Liu before her death, who put such strength in your heart? When she says it's love, there are moments in the death of Liu which any soprano just dreams to get a chance of putting
Indeed.
Across on the stage.
I'm sure it'll happen. It usually does happen at Turandot performances. As Liu comes on stage for the curtain calls, she gets the warmest applause. Turandot's had a much harder opera, but of course she's not such an appealing character in spite of her melt at the end. Liu has always got this wonderful lyricism, this very touching story, and she always just takes the show.
We shall see what happens
yes.
ere long. And here is the conductor, Dan Ettinger, bringing the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, concertmaster Sergei Levitin, to their feet, to the cheers of a packed house here at the Royal Opera House.
Thank you. Resisto più.
Alla
Thank you.
the end of Act 3 of Turandot, Puccini's last opera, here at the Royal Opera House, conducted by Dan Ettinger, with an enthusiastic audience beginning to give their reaction to the dancers and singers on the stage, the chorus of the Royal Opera House. William Spalding is the chorus director. There they are in their wooden balconies, looking down on the stage in the presence of the Emperor, who now rises from his throne. He's been up and down to the flies several times in the course of this performance. It's Robin Leggett, who first appeared here in the 1970s, an old company favourite in his Emperor's robes. The great red streamers are back, hanging from the flies down onto the stage. That dominant red, so important in this production. And the chorus now taking their bows from the balcony and getting a special cheer from the audience here. Robin Leggett now comes to the front of the stage, as he's done so many times over the years, the first of the principals to take his bow. Ping, Pang and Pong making a suitably vigorous entrance. Ping is Michel de Souza, a young Brazilian baritone who was in the Young Artist Programme here. Alid Hall is Pang, made his debut in the Royal Opera House a few months ago, a Welsh tenor. And Pavel Petrov is Pong, a Belarusian tenor. Timur In-Sung Sim, the Korean bass, who's been singing Lodovico here in Otello. And as we would expect, Hiblegger's Marva getting a huge cheer. Liu, a familiar soprano here, who sung Tatiana, Mimi, Donna Anna. Two audiences here at Covent Garden. And she makes her own gesture of thanks to the orchestra of the Royal Opera House. She takes her place in the lineup as Kala enters. Alexander Antonenko, Latvian tenor, is in great demand in opera houses around the world. He has been an Otello here at the Royal Opera House. Beats his chest in a gesture of thanks to the full house, which he now faces as he applauds the orchestra and his fellow performers. One singer still to join us. Here she is, Christine Gerke, New York soprano, who began singing the early repertoire, particularly Handel, and later developed the dramatic voice that we've heard in this production, has sung Elektra here at the Royal Opera House. She takes the hands of Timur and Kala and brings them all to the front of the stage. And as they retreat, Dan Ettinger joins them. Israeli conductor, working in Germany, was a protege of Daniel Barenboim. And he brings the orchestra to their feet. Sergei Levitin, the concertmaster. And the conductor now leads all the principals, with the chorus behind and the wooden balconies that tower above the stage, for a joint curtain call. Assistant chorus director joins them. And with applause still raining down on the singers, the Royal Opera Chorus and the orchestra under Dan Ettinger, it's time to leave the Royal Opera House. To thank you for being with us, from Sarah Lenton and me, and all the team here, we hand you back to the studio for the rest of the evening on BBC Radio 3.
That was James Naughtie. And don't forget that performance of Turandot will be on the Radio 3 website for the next 30 days. Meanwhile, our next opera date is on Thursday afternoon. And it's a real classic this week to mark the 10th anniversary of the death of Pavarotti. He leads a stellar cast in Donizetti's La File du Régiment. It's a 1973 recording from the Met in New York. It also stars Joan Sutherland and the conductor is Richard Bonning. That'll be at 2 o'clock on Thursday. And then next Saturday's Opera on Three revisits this year's Glyndebourne Festival with a performance of the little-known opera Hypermestra by Francesco Cavalli. William Christie conducts the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. Christopher Cook introduces the work and it starts at the same time, 6:30, next Saturday evening here on BBC Radio 3. Well, before any of that, there's a high-profile concert on Radio 3 tomorrow. It's all part of Rattle at Radio 3, celebrating Sir Simon Rattle's inaugural season as music director of the LSO. Tomorrow, he's at the Barbican for Berlioz's epic Damnation of Faust. So to get us in the mood, I thought we'd hear a bit of Berlioz now. This is a concert overture he based on Shakespeare's King Lear. Thank you. That was the concert overture King Lear by Berlioz, Colin Davis conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. And they're here with more Berlioz tomorrow, his Damnation of Faust. Simon Rattle conducts, and it starts at 6 o'clock.
On BBC Radio 4.
One of the things that's so extraordinary about this year's shortlist is that they are incredibly different. And one is just overtly a tease. I'm Joanna Trollope, and I'm the chair of the judging panel for this year's BBC National Short Story Award. The cream has risen to the top of the milk in the case of our five finalists. Some of them are very much the generation of writers who will be our established stars for the next 20 years.
Hear the shortlisted stories in this year's BBC National Short Story Award each weekday at 3:30 on BBC Radio 4.
Well, back to Radio 3. Kate Mollison presents two world premieres a bit later from the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra's Musica Viva season, including a major new work by Wolfgang Riem. That's in Here and Now at 10 o'clock.